Hi, it's another Friday. I'm John Zogby. I'm with my son and business partner, Jeremy Zogby, and this is our weekly podcast, The Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted, the United State of Democracy. What's the state of Jeremy today? How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing pretty well, and I know we're going to mix it up, and I have a few ideas, but I'm not exactly sure which angle you're going to take. So
yeah, well, there's three things I think we can talk about, and in no special order. One, of course, is there's a new jobs report, including a revision of last month's jobs report that I think is very, very interesting and could have some significant implications politically. The second issue is Facebook. Is Facebook dead? Whether it is or it isn't, $251 billion loss in one day is pretty massive. And then the third thing, we sort of hinted at this last week, didn't get into it. Are we going to war with Russia or are we not? So those are my three. There's a smorgasbord there. What do you have in mind?
Yeah, well, I mean, we could pick up with the Russia. The Facebook thing, I don't think is too very interesting. And the jobs report, I mean, I think we kind of alluded to last week about are people happy and the economic mm-hmm. numbers showing something positive, but the reality on the ground. So we didn't really get into Russia too much. And that is probably, by all account, the big story of the last week or two, although there are some other big stories that you know, maybe we can get into that are...
Well, I'll let you take the lead today. I normally do. So
okay.
Fire away.
All right. Well, okay. So we're going with Russia. All right. So if you turn on the news, everything looks like that Russia is the aggressor. Putin is the aggressor. And we're kind of fed the news that Ukraine is this country that just wants to be a part of the West, and it wants to be part of the European Union. It wants to be protected by NATO because, you know, the Russians, I mean, what are they up to? They're always up to no good. Well, that's just one side of it. And so if now, again, you know, when I look at geopolitical events, I don't. You taught me this. You don't look at it from the perspective of who's a good guy or who's a bad guy. You just kind of assume that everybody has their self-interest and maybe that everybody's the bad guy. But I hear all this noise about, you know, the evil Putin, and I'm trying to really understand what's going on. And the fact is that I've been following this very closely. You know, longtime listeners know that I lived in the Czech Republic. From the year 2007 to 2009. During that time, Putin started to become in the news cycle more and more as an aggressive president with an aggressive foreign policy. There was the issue with Georgia and South Ossetia and North Abkhazia, those breakaway nations. And then, of course, there was also the call for the Czech Republic having a missile defense system that the United States under President Bush said was to deter Iran, but Russia said, no, it's not to deter Iran, it's to deter us. And so I've been following Ukraine really since 2013, in which around that time you had a pro-Russian government. You know, whatever the election process was, you want to call it democratic, you want to say it wasn't democratic. The fact of the matter is the people voted in a pro-Russian government. There was this incident in the Maidan. There were protesters who were in the Maidan and mysterious shots fired. And then next thing you know, there was a coup d'etat. Who came to power? It was a group called Right Sector, who, if you look at their flag, eerily resembles a swastika. Right Sector, they actually have their roots in a Ukrainian fascist party. Why would the West, why would the European Union, why would NATO want to support a group with fascist roots who immediately, as they came to power, started attacking the ethnic Russians in the Donbas area of eastern Ukraine and basically waging genocide. Here's how I understand it. If you look at the history of the Soviet bloc nations after the Soviet Union fell, one by one, they went into NATO and then started to go into the European Union. And that broke the promise of George H.W. Bush, who said, not one finger, not one inch, will we go into those countries and bring them into NATO. So that promise was broken. And Ukraine is one of those last nations that, you know, the old Eastern Bloc nations that was firmly under the influence, the sphere of influence of Russia. You know, they have a 1,000-year history, Kiev Rus, and the previous administration or two of them ago were pro-Russian. They were ousted. This group came in, has been waging genocide. And my question is, what is Putin supposed to do? Is he supposed to watch his entire Western border amassed by NATO military bases and the old promise of George H.W. broken one after one? So that's how, kind of how I approach it.
Okay, I'm just going to add, you know, some color to that on my reading of history. Number one, Russia has always desired, ever since the days of Frederick Barbarossa. Now we're going back a ways, but Russia is a country that's been invaded by the West no less than three times, three major invasions. One in the late Middle Ages, the second Napoleon's invasion, the third, the massive invasion following the Russian Revolution in 1917. And then, of course, add the fourth time where 20 million Russians died and Stalin's demand was that there be, and this is part of Russian history, a cordon sanitaire, a belt around Russia that was a buffer zone that would mitigate any new Russian invasion. So that's important. And again, let me reiterate what I taught you and which you eloquently just put. We're not dealing with good guys versus bad guys here. Putin is not a good guy by any stretch of the imagination, but he is traditionally Russian. He's got a bit of Soviet in him as well. But there's a consistent pattern to who he is and what he stands for. The second thing that's worthy of note, I just read an article a few days ago in The Atlantic, in which it points out that going back that 1,000 years, Russia got its identity from Ukraine. They were joined at the hip. There was no Russia without Ukraine. And to a great degree, Ukrainians internalized that over the years. There certainly is a desire for independence by the Ukrainian people. There's certainly, by most of the Ukrainian people, there also is a sense on the part of Russians that Ukraine is organic to the state of Russia. There's some tension there between the two, not a happy marriage, never been a happy marriage, but a marriage nonetheless culturally. The third thing I would add is, let's make a list of anybody who gains from a Russian West war right now. I don't have anybody to put on that list. Putin would be, I mean, you got to assume, no matter how bad leaders are as people, that they think rationally to some degree, and nobody wants to be the last president of a country that no longer exists or that has faced massive casualties. So Putin has nothing to gain from that, and any effort to take over the Ukraine would would backfire. Ukrainians don't want it. You see the president, prime minister, foreign minister of Ukraine saying, this is not an imminent war. Yeah, we're in danger. We feel threatened. But, you know, let's not rush this. We're still all talking here. The United States doesn't want war. It can't want war. What do we possibly achieve from it? What have we achieved from going to war in the last 50, 60 years? NATO doesn't want war. The issue of Ukraine joining NATO is a moot one because NATO doesn't want Ukraine. And so this is all a real puzzle to me. And I'm wondering what the manufacturing of this crisis is all about. And I say that cautiously, but it does appear to be, I mean, look, there are over 120,000 troops, Russian troops massed all along north and east of the Ukraine border. But is somebody going to step over the line? Is there going to be an incident manufactured like the Gulf of Tonkin resolution? God, I hope not.
Well, you know, you're talking about rational leaders don't want war, but then why is the West precipitating war? You know, it goes back to my question, how did this ousting of the pro-Russian government happen? Who ousted them? I don't want to get into that, but it looks like it has its fingerprints somewhere in the West, whether that's broadly the European Union somewhere in there or broadly in NATO. I can't pinpoint it exactly, although it looks suspicious that after they ousted the pro-Russian government and brought in a historically fascist party that immediately started a civil war, Victoria Nuland, who was in the Obama administration, announced that there would be this natural gas company. See, a lot of this, I think, has to do with resources geopolitically and strategically from the vantage point of the West, because Russia does have a stronghold over Europe. Europe gets their gas, they get their oil largely from Russia. And when the EU get together and they point the finger at Russia and say that they're bad or that they, you know, that they want to sanction Russia, Russia has that leverage. Well, if you're going to criticize us, then maybe we won't deliver our gas. And so lo and behold, Ukraine has natural gas fields. And so I think that plays a role into it. And so when Victoria Nuland announced that, and in the background was a Chevron logo, and then there was this Burisma energy company that was formed, lo and behold, Hunter Biden was on the board. Joe Biden, of course, was the vice president under the Obama administration. It doesn't look really good. It looks really bad. So to the point about, you know, rational leaders not wanting war, the Obama administration didn't really act rationally in its engagement with Russia. If anything, I think at the end of the George W. Bush administration and the entire Obama administration, they poked the Russian bear. I think had they just left it alone and just accepted the fact that a dozen countries that were formerly under the Soviet bloc had now been brought into NATO and brought into the EU, just leave it alone there. But there's an obsession within the intelligence community, certain aspects of the intelligence community that want to see Russia off the map, cannot come to terms with the fact that Russia, along with China, can be a powerful player in a multipolar world. This is just the inability of the behemoth empire led by, rogue elements within the intelligence agency that just have it out for Russia and want to see their demise in all of this. We're now, now there's talk about the brink of war. I don't think it's going to get to that, but here's the other thing. It also serves as a distraction. You know, you were talking about the manufacturing of this crisis. And so here we are, and we look to our neighbors in the north in Ottawa, and tens of thousands of a convoy, a trucker convoy are parking out in front of the parliament, and they're calling for an end to the mandates. They're calling for an end to what they call the COVID regime. Justin Trudeau is nowhere to be found. It's kind of like, the lead up to the French Revolution. And I'm not going to say it's going to go that direction, but basically by the week, the COVID narrative is falling apart. And actually there's going to be a similar convoy trucking of American truckers from the West Coast going to DC. And so you're going to see this everywhere in the world. Remember, 2019 was the year of the protest. People were taken to the streets. Well, they're still taken to the streets, but now the truckers are taken to the road and they're parking in the capitals by the thousands. And they're demanding an end to be treated as second-class citizens. And then while this is building up, lo and behold, you know, we're back to the World War III scenario with Russia.
Okay, those are some mighty leaps there, and I'm certainly not prepared to go. Let's just put a lid on this conversation by reminding, you know, our viewers and listeners and ourselves that there's still South Ossetia, there's still Chechnya, there is still that battle for Russia's cordon sanitaire. This is, if not a burgeoning war situation, this is still a border crisis of some sort. So where do we go from here? You don't want to talk unemployment or employment. I do.
Well, sure. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Unemployment.
Well, okay, real numbers. So 467,000 new jobs created. That's triple what economists were projecting. Not only that, last month's anemic numbers of only a couple hundred thousand new jobs created actually was revised upward. This is not uncommon, but revised upwards to 709,000 new jobs. So we're looking at 1.3 million jobs. Most of those, of course, non-farm jobs. Looking at almost a 1% rise in wages. We're looking at some significant progress. Unemployment rate is up from 3.9 to 4, but that's because more people have gone back into the economy. So looks like, good news all the way around. The biggest growth sectors, of course, are food and hospitality and retail. That's where the biggest hits had been taken. I think it's good news, and I always have my eye out for Novembers. You know, Reggie Jackson was Mr. October. I'm sort of Mr. Early November, always looking at what's going to go on by Election Day. This has to be some better news, I would think, for Joe Biden.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least for today. I mean, I can tell you Monday morning, Biden's approval rating is not going to be up to high 40s or low 50s. Nope. Or even make 50. So it's a disaster. I mean, when are we going to call a spade a spade? I mean, seriously, week after week. Yeah, we can always look to find some good news in the numbers. But as you know, the numbers are cooked. The numbers don't really calculate things as they are on the ground. How many of those hospitality and restaurant jobs are full-time? How many of them are part-time without insurance? That's kind of like something that's overlooked. And the headlines and the data and the headlines can only have an effect for so long, which is maybe a few hours before reality sinks back in. And the reality is the public is still divided. Polls have been showing that have come out this week that Americans aren't very hopeful about Biden, who ran on unity and his ability to bring about that unity. And I don't see how it's beyond a few hours good news for Joe Biden.
Okay, last word.
Maybe
because I've been the last. Okay.
Remember last episode, you cut me off a couple times.
Oh, that's how we did it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You did remember that, didn't you? Okay. I think when we talk about good news, bad news, at least in my case, I'm not making a partisan comment, although I am a Democrat. But the case I am making is public perception. And so for Joe Biden, the issue more than anything else right now, this is what's happened with our politics, is what will bring out the base and what might chisel off his negative numbers among independents. And what I'm saying is that while I don't think anybody gets a massive a bump in polls anymore these days because we're so frozen in a partisan way, I do think that may be enough to get back significant portions of the base and maybe turn some independents around if this is sustained. Now, the other thing, and my final point, is voters are still going to have an option. So on one hand, Democrats lose when they can't bring out their base in off-year elections, you know, in congressional elections. On the other hand, there still has to be an opportunity for voters to say, you know, rather than stay home, I think the Republican candidate or the Republican Party is going to do better. I'm not seeing that yet. So that's basically, you know, what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's going to be very difficult because as I mentioned in the last podcast, the segregation of information and the parallel universes, and you and I try to break that with this podcast where, you know, we have different narratives and we have different observations of what's going on, but we come together and we talk about it peacefully. And by and large, we address each other's points. Although, you know, a lot of times things just go on deaf ears. That's still happening with the public where the conversations aren't really coming together. And you know, I have to say a lot of that is because of our president and the media that the media that buttresses the basic narrative, the mainstream narrative, and shuns out anything that doesn't fall in into that narrative. And so when you have these alternative narratives, people are just being, they're drifting away, they're drifting apart from each other. And that's a major source of tension. That's a major source of divisiveness. And if they're not allowed in some kind of forum to come together and address the points, address the narratives, maybe not face to face, but directly, then parties are going to walk away with false notions and just basically be driven apart further. I can't help but think of in the lead up to the Civil War, if you looked at the political cartoons of what the South thought about the North and what the North thought about the South. And yet there was little interaction and there was becoming less and less interaction. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy of if we can't talk to each other and address each other civilly, then eventually it's going to spill over. And that's precisely what we have. And so that's what concerns me. And I don't see the Biden administration doing anything to address that. I don't think they can, really. But that's my last word.
Okay, and that will be the final word. So I get the next six final words on these podcasts.
That sounds fair.
Have a good week. I'll actually talk to you in a few minutes. Okay,
sure.
Bye, everybody.
Take care.